invite the lawyers to stay?
Oh, if the lawyers would like to stay for the next argument and also to answer any questions from the students, that would be great. And if not, that's fine too. But you're certainly invited to stay and speak with them if you would like to. All right, so now we're on to the next case. It's case number 68747, Prentice Marshall versus State. And again, make sure that both counsel identify yourselves for the record. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Orm. I represent Prentice Marshall. This is an issue about whether Mr. Marshall's confession to being involved in the killing of an off-duty police officer was freely and voluntarily given. One thing that may be of interest to the viewers in this particular case is that Prentice Marshall was a star basketball player. 24 hours before he is arrested for this capital case, he was a star basketball player at Mojave High School basketball for Mojave High School. He was the guard there looking at potential Division I scholarships, and 24 hours later, he was arrested and shortly thereafter pending or had the threat of a death sentence hanging over his head. Mr. Marshall's case is peculiar to be up on appeal given the fact that there was entry of a plea to all charges. Part of the advantage to that was we avoided a sentence of death. The state had been very reluctant to ever make an offer in this case. 4.5 years into it, the state made an offer. We were able to convince Mr. Marshall that that was in his best interest, but he insisted that we be able to appeal this issue to this court. And so I am making the representations that his plea, or excuse me, that his statement was not freely and voluntarily given. Mr. Marshall was shot in the testicles and the bullet came out of his rear end. His sister took him to North Vista Hospital where they began to perform give him medical attention. Because he said he had been robbed, when he was asked what had happened, he said he'd been robbed and shot. Officer Smith showed up from North Las Vegas, began questioning him. His story didn't appear to make much sense to her. And at some point, she recognizes he may be a suspect in the homicide of this off-duty police officer. She then escorts him to University Medical Center because the medical attention he needs is much more severe. When he gets there, she has followed him. She stays outside. The two main detectives questioning Mr. Marshall, investigating the homicide, show up. They are Detective Serranowitz and Detective Antonowitz, very similar names. And they begin to question Mr. Marshall. In truth, they say to him, you don't have to answer these questions, you can have us leave. But this young man is under the influence of morphine. He's being treated by multiple caregivers at that point. And more importantly, I would ask the court to look at 7AA 871. It's an intake sheet at UMC, and it shows at 4:30 a.m. that Mr. Marshall, there is a police hold. Now, I am using that liberally, and I would not want the court to look at it and say, it doesn't say at 4:30 a.m. there's a police hold. It doesn't say that. What it does say is that it says 4:30, it says the date, and then in big letters it says police hold. It also describes the description of him, and later on it says it twice in that document. That is our contention, that at the time he came to UMC, he had been placed on hold. He was not free to leave.
Let me ask you this. The premise of Miranda, as you know, is you have to be in custody. If you're not in custody, if you're not in police custody, the police don't have to read your Miranda warnings. So he goes to the first hospital, North Vista, and he reports himself to be a victim of a crime, and the police come in and interview him as a victim. You're saying that at some point after he arrives at UMC, he's in custody, but when did that happen?
All I can ascertain, first of all, I agree with you. That's accurate. He goes there voluntarily with his sister because he needs medical attention. They don't believe
he effectively initiates police contact by saying, I'm the victim of a crime, and any objective person, I think you would agree with me, would say, well, no, the police are going to come and talk to you. That's just what's going to happen. So you're saying at some point by the time he gets to UMC, he's then in custody. But what I'm asking you is, when are you asserting that happened?
I'm asserting that happens when he becomes a suspect in Officer Nettleton's killing. And that happens before he gets to UMC. And at UMC, you have that one document where it does say police hold, and that is at 4:30 a.m. in the morning. The relevancy of the 4:30 a.m. is Officer Saronowitz at the evidentiary hearing says he arrives about 5:30 in the morning. So before the detectives are showing up, homicide detectives are showing up, there's a police hold on him. So my contention is at that point, there's a hold, and he is in custody. And then you look at all the other circumstances, and I believe in our state, Your Honor, we look at Allward and Taylor, the factors, and we look at the site, the focus on the defendant. Does this look like an arrest, length of questioning?
Well, Mr. Orm, the district court agreed with the state that Marshall was lucid when he made his confession, and ultimately the district court denied the motion to suppress. Isn't the district court in the best position to determine lucidity, to actually listen to the CD? The district court judge sits and listens to the CD of the confession and the interaction between the detectives and the patient slash defendant to explain as to whether or not this is voluntary versus coerced. So why would, and maybe you can explain to us then, how the district court's factual finding would be clearly wrong in this case?
Well, I would argue it is incorrect for a number of different reasons. Yes, you could listen to the confession orally, and it does sound like the individual is answering the questions that are being answered. I can't argue otherwise. However, look at the totality of the circumstances. That's what the law dictates, the totality of the circumstances. There's no argument that he was not under morphine. There's no argument that this occurs at 5 in the morning. He would have sleep deprivation at that point. Because as a high school student, you know, 5 in the morning, if you haven't gone to sleep, you're going to be tired. He has been questioned, and he's been told already, we don't believe you. We know you're lying. We know, we've talked to Saul Williams, who is the co-defendant in the homicide, and he's told us you did it. He's told us you're responsible. So he was already overborne by the police presence, by the questioning by the police. So if the question simply is, if we listen to a tape recording, does this man sound lucid, then I'm going to lose that argument every single time, because you're going to listen and you're going to say, Your Honor, yes, he's lucid. But that doesn't encompass the totality of circumstances that I think the court was required to look at, and this court is required to
look at. Well, not every time. I mean, sometimes if somebody's on morphine, which is, again, an extremely serious drug, they may very well have slurred speech. Maybe they're not understanding a question that's asked of them. They're not responding to the question that's being asked. So you can sometimes determine if somebody's lucid or not from a tape. It's not you're going to lose every single time.
No, I meant in this case. I'm going to lose every single time. Because if you listen to it, you would say he was lucid.
He sounds lucid.
He doesn't.
Okay.
Yes, and that's what I meant. Now, I'm sure there are times people are on morphine where you can't understand anything. Maybe they're in and out of consciousness. But in this case, I'm going to lose every single time.
Okay.
But, you know, he's being deceived by the police as well. They're telling him things that are not true. One of the most important things is they tell him that we've talked to Officer, they don't say Officer Nelson, we've talked to the man. He's fine. And so obviously this takes an 18-year-old and thinks, okay, fine, it's not that serious. And then when they're done and he confesses, they say, by the way, he's dead. And by the way, he was a police officer. So he was being deceived. If we look at the totality of circumstances in the case, the police-dominated atmosphere, the fact that he was being deceived, the fact that he was ultimately arrested, the fact that he is essentially, he has IVs connected to him, he can't go anywhere, he's being brought from one hospital to the other. In addition, there's a police guard outside, and there's a hold on him. He's in custody.
Those circumstances, as you presented, sound like he's restrained. But isn't it also what the person that's being interviewed actually knows? For example, did he know there was a hold on him? Is a hold the same as an arrest? Or did he find out when the officers told him later, you're now under arrest for murder? And then about the officer standing outside the door. Did he know there was an officer standing outside the door? I mean, there were a lot of things that are alleged here, but it's not, the evidence didn't come out at the hearing that your client actually knew all these things.
That's correct. And I guess what the court is looking at is the Supreme Court has said we look at what is the belief of a reasonable, innocent person. That's the stat. And so I think that's what the court is getting at. However, if he is in a hospital, but he's going to see police all around, he realizes that they had done a gunshot residue test on him. He would see that happening. He would see them taking pictures of him. If he ever saw Officer Smith outside the door at UMC, he would realize that's the officer.
There's not any of that in the record on appeal.
Outside the door, whether Officer Smith...
Outside the door, the gunshot residue?
Yes.
I mean, we know it happened, but is it in the record on appeal so we can actually look at it?
No, Mr. Marshall did not testify at the evidentiary hearing. However, with the gunshot residue, and then if he didn't know that it happened to him, then we have to assume that the morphine was so significant that he didn't even understand what was going on.
So this might be a good time. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Can you give that to me?
Yeah.
You want to finish your thought? Or?
No, I'm fine. I'll take my 5 minutes. Goodbye. Thank you.
Sorry. I forgot to ask.
Good morning. My name is Pamela Weckerly. I work for the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and I was the prosecutor on the state versus Prentice Marshall along with co-counsel. Mr. Oram touched on the unique procedural posture of this case, given that there was a guilty plea, but subject to that guilty plea was Mr. Marshall was permitted to appeal the district court's decision on the suppression of his statements. Back when that was litigated before the trial court, there were actually three statements at issue. There were two initially taken by Detectives Antonowitz and Serranowitz, as Mr. Oram explained, and then there was a third statement taken not at the hospital after Mr. Marshall was already in custody, and that statement was suppressed by the trial court. The facts that brought the detectives to the hospital at UMC that evening is sort of an interplay of two events. Initially, Mr. Marshall and three other individuals approached the open garage of an off-duty Metro officer. He had just finished his shift, and he was in his garage with the bay door open, putting away his weapon when Mr. Marshall approached with a gun along with another individual and two others. One acted as a lookout and one waited in the car. As Mr. Marshall approached, there was an attempt to rob Mr. Nettleton, and he actually was able to fire a round off himself in addition to being shot, and that was the round that struck Mr. Marshall. And after he got struck with the weapon, he ran to the home of his co-defendant, and ultimately it was his sister, as Justice Tao pointed out, who brought him to the hospital at North Vista. And that was the first place that he put himself in and ultimately caused the police to encounter him because he was claiming that he was a victim of a robbery. The first officer that speaks to Mr. Marshall was a patrol officer, and she thinks she's going to talk and interview a robbery victim about getting shot. And she arrives at North Vista Hospital, and she encounters Mr. Marshall, who of course tells her a lie about how it was that he ended up getting injured that night. He describes a location where he says he was the victim of a robbery, and he describes someone else shooting him. I disagree with Mr. Oram's rendition of the facts where he says that this officer ultimately was the one who escorted Prentice Marshall to UMC, where he ended up getting subsequent treatment. That wasn't the testimony at the suppression hearing. Officer Smith testified that there was a decision made about his treatment. North Vista couldn't do the procedure, so he was transported based on, I guess, the medical demands of his situation to UMC Hospital. He rode in an ambulance, and she followed behind, but significantly, and this was her testimony at the hearing, she didn't give any instructions to the ambulance driver. She didn't tell anyone, hey, look, I'm following. She didn't tell any hospital staff, let me know when you unload him because I'm following this guy. None of that occurred. She was still treating this as an instance where someone is reporting that he is a victim of a robbery.
But by the time they do get over to UMC, I mean, the second prong, because we're talking about the confession at UMC anyway.
Sure.
The second prong of whether a defendant's in custody for purposes of arrest revolves around whether or not the investigation had focused on him as a suspect. And here, although defendant Marshall claimed to be a victim of crime, despite the egregious facts. This is a murder of a police officer in his own home. So how can the state maintain that Marshall wasn't the focus of Officer Nettleton's murder investigation by the time that the detectives went to UMC to interview him?
I think he was. I mean, the detectives have a suspicion. Well, that's not a crime, though, on the test of whether or not he's in custody for purposes of Miranda, because the case law in Oregon versus Mathiasen and California versus Salisbury says it's irrelevant what the police think, whether they think he's a suspect or not. And certainly, as I'm sure the court's aware, the officers know, like, well, the victim in our murder case fired a round. Right. Here we have this guy arriving at a hospital with a gunshot wound. Maybe these two things are connected. But when the detectives ultimately arrive at UMC, there was...
What time was it when they arrived?
The patient notes, and this is in the record on appeal, indicate that the detectives get there at 5:30, and this is volume 7 at 878 on the record on appeal. Mr. Oram did spend some time talking about this 4:30 alleged hold that was placed. This was obviously, I'm sure this is no shock, a subject of dispute in the suppression hearing. And the documents that they're actually relying on are forms that were completed for Mr. Marshall's stay at UMC. So it wasn't just that he was treated and released. He was actually, he actually stayed at the hospital for a certain amount of time. And his arrival, indeed, as Mr. Oram said, was at 4:30. In those records, and when you look at them, they are also in the record on appeal, that just shows what time he arrived. Those records go on to state a discharge plan, the extent of pain he's in, what kind of risk he'd be if he were put in a hospital bed in terms of a fall. So certainly nothing in those records indicates that a police hold was placed concurrently with his arrival at 4:30 that morning. And indeed, the only officer that went there near that time was Officer Smith, and her testimony was that she didn't place a hold. And significantly, the only two witnesses at this suppression hearing were Officer Smith and Detective Saranowicz. The patient notes also indicate that the detectives arrived at about 5:30 in the morning, and that would be Detectives Antonowicz and Saranowicz. And they start their questioning of the defendant. There's notes from 6:30 that the police are present. Patient appears calm and comfortable with investigators. And then it's at 6:45 that the notes indicate that there was a hold placed at this point. So it's none of the records, I think, bear out that there was no hold until 6:45. But even if there had been a hold placed, under Taylor, it's from the perspective of Mr. Marshall, and there's no indication that he thought there was any hold on him. He didn't testify at the hearing. He never testified that he thought his movement was restricted. He never testified that, hey, I knew there was a police hold on me as soon as I got there at 4:30. He never testified, I thought I wasn't free to leave. I thought they wouldn't leave me alone. And he significantly never testified, I didn't know what was going on because I had been given morphine because of the pain. So all of those factors, I think, suggest that he was not in police custody upon his arrival and that there was a hold obviously placed later. But in context, we know now that was after he was Mirandized and gave the second statement. Now, Mr. Oram talked to some extent on the voluntariness aspect of his statement, in addition to claiming that he should have been Mirandized because he was in custody. And as this court is aware, it's the Taylor case that tells us what are the, or the Passima case that tells us what factors relate to the voluntariness of the statement. And none of the factors in that case weigh in favor of Mr. Marshall except maybe one. It's true he was youthful, that's one of the factors, but he had had contacts with the police, and he also was sophisticated enough not only to lie to the initial responding officer, but he also repeated that lie to the detectives upon their arrival. Lack of education is another Passima factor. There's been no indication that Mr. Marshall suffered from low IQ or had any problem expressing himself. Advisement of rights is another factor. The detectives clearly in the audio, which the district court heard, when making the ruling, said, hey, look, we want to put it out there. You don't have to talk to us. Obviously, he's in a hospital setting, so they can't say, you're free to go, but they say, you can tell us to leave, and we'll leave. You don't need to talk to us. So he was advised of his rights on the first statement, and of course, on the second statement, he was given his proper Miranda rights. The length of detention is another factor for Passama. The whole length of this detention was 50 minutes in terms of the interviewing, but he wasn't detained at all because he was in a hospital setting that he chose to avail himself of because he wanted treatment from his injuries. So that factor doesn't play in his favor as well. Another factor is if there's prolonged questioning, but there's been case law from the Ninth Circuit that says 2.5 hours isn't prolonged, and in this case, we only have 50 minutes of questioning. And lastly, the last factor is whether or not there was, you know, deprivation of food or water. And we know in this case that he was in a hospital setting and his pain, any injuries he had, everything was being attended to because the detective and the officer both testified that medical personnel came and went and treated and assessed Mr. Marshall's injuries as they were talking to him.
Ms. Whiteley, Mr. Orem mentioned that he thought an important factor was the police gave him false information. They said they had talked to the officer, the victim, and other things that weren't exactly accurate, you know, talking to a co-defendant. And that in and of itself is sufficient to overcome his will there, not give an accurate or voluntary statement.
I think it depends on the nature of the questioning. I think you could get to a point where the tactics used by the police are so egregious that you would find that as a factor that weighed in his favor. However, in general, the U.S. Supreme Court has held on numerous occasions, and this is Mathiasen as well, that some form of deception is perfectly acceptable, and it doesn't render someone in custody, nor does it change the voluntariness analysis of a statement. And in this case, where the district court heard all the audio, the lies that, or the deception that the police told were pretty minimal. Hey, we talked to your friend, and they didn't go into details about what the friend said, and we talked to the victim, but they didn't go into details about that. There weren't threats, there weren't, hey, look, you are in big trouble. There wasn't a lot of pressure applied to them, Mr. Marshall. It was more just, hey, you know, why don't you tell us what happened?
What about promises? Things will go better for you if you talk to us.
There were no promises made in that regard, and that would be a violation of his rights if there was a purported exchange, like if you remain silent, you're not going to get this benefit. But none of that took place, and the district court already made that finding. The other thing I would say just factually that's sort of significant in terms of his voluntariness is after he finished the first statement, the police go out and take a break and kind of figure out, hey, what do we have here? And then he tells the nurse, hey, will you bring them back in? I want to say something else. I want to explain something else. And that fact, to me, suggests that he wasn't intimidated by the police. He wasn't in a situation where he wanted this over right away. He summoned them back in, and that's when they Mirandize him, and he makes the second statement that we're talking about in this case. So all of those factors, I think, point to the fact that although he was medicated, that was a medically appropriate administration of pain medication because he did have serious injuries, but it's not enough to render him incapable of voluntarily speaking to the police and choosing to make a statement. The other thing is, I think Justice Silver pointed this out, when the suppression hearing went on, the trial court had the benefit of hearing the exchange between the detectives and Mr. Marshall. And she could hear that their voices weren't raised. She could hear that they weren't threatening him. She could hear that he was lucid, that he was tracking events. She could hear that he wasn't slurring his speech or that he wasn't confused. And so although he had been given medication, that was under a doctor's care, it was appropriate, and it didn't sort of change his cognition to the point where we wouldn't be able to recognize this statement as one made voluntarily. So the voluntariness prong also does not weigh in favor of Mr. Marshall as well. And so unless the court has any additional questions.
What about on the voluntariness? Even though the trial court ruled against the motion to suppress, couldn't the defense have still taken this to trial and said to the jury, we don't think this was voluntary. You can look at it and make that determination using all these factors that are being discussed here, plus whatever else they came up with.
They could have raised that a voluntariness issue at trial, certainly on, and that would be in the form of a jury instruction. In this particular case, it would have been kind of a difficult argument, in my opinion, because right after this, he gets on a jail call and admits committing the crime to his mother. So we probably, and he had the gunshot wound, which was sort of evidence that, hey, look, he's the guy that attempted to rob the off-duty metro officer.
So from a defense point of view, you probably wouldn't want to use that strategy.
They don't often take my advice on how to do their case, but I would have thought that would
much
be a little
to your case. Chagrin.
Yes, but that would have been a stretch in my mind, no matter how they approached it. They had some difficult facts to overcome in this case, for sure.
Thank you, Ms. Lockerly. Mr. Arn, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. State's correct. We had difficult facts. But as I hear the state go through Passava and the different parts of the test, I think there were a lot in favor of Mr. Marshall. First of all, the first factor is age, the youth at the time. He was 18 years old. Education, he hadn't graduated high school. So those first two factors, I think, were in our favor. Lack of advice regarding the Constitution. At the time of the first statement, before they come back in for what I call the second statement, he had been given no constitutional admonition at all, nothing at all. He wasn't advised that he had a right to an attorney. He wasn't advised that he had a right to remain silent. None of those things. That weighs in our favor. The length of the detention, they like to point out that the recording itself, how long that is. Really, what I would argue is that the length started when he started to be questioned by Officer Smith. They did the gunshot residue test. They photographed him. She's following him. The state was right when I say escorted him. She was in the back, in a vehicle behind the ambulance, went to UMC. That takes a considerable period of time. And so I thought the length of detention, again, weighed in favor of Mr. Marshall.
Didn't Mr. Marshall extend it by asking the police to come back in the room?
For the second statement?
Yes.
Yes, he does make that statement. He says, could they come back in the room? And then Moran
sounds like a pretty powerful argument for the state that his will wasn't overborne, he was lucid, and at the time of it wasn't really a factor.
I think what we have to look at, because I think if you take that in a vacuum, I agree. But the totality of the circumstances, I think, is different. When I look at the Nevada Supreme Court's decision in Rhodes, they say once the first statement is tainted, then if there's not a gap between the second, it is also tainted. So what had already happened at the time they leave, I would argue the taint had already occurred, and therefore the second statement should be suppressed as well. So if I go back through the factors, the repeated questioning, he's being questioned, they've told him they don't believe him, he's been questioned by a number of different officers. Again, I think that weighs in our favor. And then finally, deprivation of food or drink, or sleep. And in this case, they didn't deprive him of it. He just didn't have much sleep. He was under the influence of powerful narcotics. If you look at the totality of the circumstances, I would argue that his first statement and second statement was not freely involved.
But here's your
evidence of deprivation of sleep? I mean, if it's 4 in the morning, you're taking morphine, you're really tired, you're going to fall asleep. Was there any evidence that he ever fell asleep when the police woke him up?
No. There's nothing to suggest that. The deprivation of sleep is simply my argument that at 5 in the morning people would be tired.
He gets to the first hospital, North Bay, around 1 in the morning, right?
Yes.
The Miranda warning and the definite arrest comes around, I'm gathering, around 5:30-ish. So there's a 4.5-hour space there. Now, we know that at some point he's transported from one hospital to the other, but my question is this, for that 4.5-hour period of time, And I'm not clear about this. Is there a police officer continuously in the room? Aren't the doctors in there treating him? Is he sleeping? What exactly happens during the 4.5 hours? Because it seems like you're saying that's all an interrogation, that's all custody. But was there actually an officer in the room, or what's going on for 4 hours?
According to Officer Chastity Smith, she is always present in or around the room, even at North Vista. She's outside of the hospital room. When they transport him, she is behind the ambulance. When they get him to UMC, she is constantly present outside of the room. So the idea that he may not have seen the officer could be true. I did not put Mr. Marshall on, so maybe that is true. But she testified she was always present until the homicide detective showed up.
Well, he was shot in his private area.
Right.
So it's not like she was sitting, because she's a female and he's a male, the whole time in the room.
Correct. She's not. She's outside. She does go in and out, but medical personnel are going in and out. I just would want to dispute one fact. The police officers say the homicide detectives say they arrived at 5:30. They didn't Mirandize him right then, because then they get him to make the statement, and then he invites them back in, and then they Mirandize him. So I would think around 6:30 would Miranda warnings were probably given. I can see that my time is just about up. With that, if there's no further questions, I'll submit it to the court.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This matter now stands submitted.